We're in the Machine Perception Laboratory of the Cal IT2 building on the UC San Diego campus with Andrea Chiba, who's a behavioral neuroscientist here. She's involved with the Graduate Neuroscience Program. But more importantly for our purposes, you're the scientific director of the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center, the TDLC, which is the NSF-funded Science of Learning Center, which has its primary base here at UC San Diego. Did I get all that right?
Yes.
How do you find any time to sleep with all these jobs is my next question.
I'm also part of cognitive science is my home department.
All right.
Also,
so,
if you can
so
slip that in.
You have four hats.
Yes.
And not much spare time. All right. Give me some sort of a sense of what you do. I think of you as a rat runner. You have a rat lab. You study the... Why don't you just give me some sort of context about this and how it fits into the whole TDLC mission?
Right. So behavioral neuroscience can encompass a lot of things. And in my lab, we actually do rodent behavioral models of cognition. And it's a stretch to say that you can study the rodent and understand human cognition, but on the other hand, there's a vast amount of neuroanatomy that's been maintained and conserved between rodents and humans. As a matter of fact, the rodent brain is more like the human brain than, say, the dolphin brain or the dog brain. And so that's one of the reasons there are so many studies on rodents, actually. And so we basically teach rodents fancy tricks and then look to see the underlying neurobiology of this action, of this cognition that's going on in the rodents. And one of the things that we've looked at for a long time is sequence learning, or how is it that these sequences of activity build up both in behavior and in the brain in the rodent. But we also look at basic learning and memory functions and the way in which affect and attention modulate learning memory at the most basic level. So a lot of times you look at cognition in what I call a sort of flat world. And that is, people look at basic visual function, basic sequences, and they don't think of the idea that there's really nothing very neutral in our environment, that most things have some sort of value to an organism. You know, if I see a person or I see an object, it's likely that I have some sort of affect or emotion associated with that. So we like to look at the way in which affect alters these things, motivational state of the animal, and how that helps them to pay more or less attention in learning.
Okay, so I don't think most people think of it this way, that the organism is not just out there chilling or having a good time. It's actually a bioenergetic organism.
Right.
And if it's all its energy runs down, it's an ex-organism. So what it's doing is in service of navigating through social space and other things to keep its bioenergetic bank balance in the black, if you like.
Right.
And what I understood you to be saying is that it's one of the things it's doing as part of this is assigning value to its exploratory activities. So when you talk about, you know, its affect is important and its attention is important and how it assigns value to things, could you give me some sort of more specific description of how that works?
Right, so we're always going towards a positive state for the organism in an adaptive creature. There are creatures that go into a maladaptive state also. So we want to survive first and foremost, but when biological pressure is removed, then, you know, we want to be happy. We become hedonists in that case. So we want to maximize the greater good for ourselves, for the world, and we want to minimize the bad. And so in that case, we learn to navigate our environment accordingly. So if I'm not going to walk down a dark alley where I think something bad is going to happen to me, I am going to go into a store that smells good and looks like a happy place where I may find enjoyment. And even the smallest things in life take on affective value when you wouldn't expect them to. I give the example of, say, my running shoes. You know, a pair of shoes is functional, you know, so they're sort of good, but there's no big deal to a pair of running shoes. But when I take them out of my closet, my dogs do a little dance, like they're the happiest things on earth, and I get this little pit in my stomach, like, ugh, because I'm not that good a runner. And so they hold a really different value to the dogs versus to me. And just about every item in our environment is like that. It holds some value to the viewer. And when you walk into a setting, even the perception you're going to take in from that setting involves tracking, those things are of value to you. So you can look at differential exploration in a rat or differential eye tracking in a human and see that the way they track their environment is guided by these things that are important to them. So that means that every individual is going to have a different perception of the world from the get-go based on what it is that they like and dislike and what will get them something.
Okay, so what's a source of eudaimonia, as a philosopher would put it, or well-being, or what makes a happy rat?
What makes a happy rat? Food makes a happy rat. Comfort makes a happy rat. Enjoyment, pleasure, playing, you know, entertainment.
Same stuff.
Yeah, same stuff, right. In the wild, a happy rat needs to just be a surviving rat. They don't want to get eaten by a hawk or a snake. But in our laboratory, the rat doesn't have threats. And so then it chooses, you know, chocolate over a little sugar. It learns to choose the novel or more interesting toy over the old hat. It learns to explore the nooks and crannies of environment and notice contextual changes. That's very much like us exploring our worlds.
Right, so are you tracking what's going on neuronally while that is happening, while it's learning certain pathways?
I'm sorry, I missed one of your words.
Neuronal pathways.
Oh, okay.
So what's happening in the rat's brain? Presumably in its hippocampus, there are certain cells which are recording where it's going and so on. And
right.
Keeping a track of what's a good trajectory and what was a useless trajectory and so on. How does that work?
Right, so we like to think of the architecture of the brain as somewhat of a roadmap to which structures should be doing what for function. And that is that, you know, the brain is not equivalent in its landscape. You know, there are different receptors for different neurochemicals in certain locations. Different things are connected to other structures in interesting ways and interesting proportionalities. And that anatomy gives us a clue as to what the structure should be doing. For example, take the amygdala, a structure that I've done a lot of work on. That structure's had a lot of interesting press regarding its role in emotion. And one thing that's interesting about that structure is that it gets all this direct sensory input that other structures aren't privy to, other than the thalamus. And it actually has these interesting back projections to primary sensory areas that people thought were vestigial, actually, initially in the rodent until they also discovered them in the primate. Then it has its hands on every neuromodulator so that it can activate cortex in different ways. And so it's a very interesting structure regarding modulating other areas of the brain. And so we looked at that in terms of we looked at the neurons within the amygdala regarding how an animal would build up value to some neutral item.
And the stories in the press you often see about the amygdala is often to do with stories that are about fear, right? Which will be an absolutely fundamental response.
Right.
You're saying that it's some kind of command central that responds to these potentially life-threatening situations. And what do you mean by back projection?
Well, so usually, say you have different visual pathways in the brain, what's very interesting is you get visual information going directly into the amygdala, into the basolateral amygdala, and those neurons in the basolateral amygdala actually project to primary visual cortex. That's very unusual. And so they could give a low sort of threshold functional input to amp up or down the visual cortex according to whether something is important or not to quickly perceive. Mm-hmm. And so that's where timing comes in also. That might be kind of a coarse input, but it should be a very rapid one because it's direct. And so I think of the amygdala as sort of a smart gut. You know, it's not 100% accurate, but on the other hand, it's very rapid and it does provide a lot of useful information to other structures.
So if you were walking down that dark alley you talked about before, it's working.
Right. Right. And if it isn't working, you're likely to continue walking down the dark alley with no expectation that something bad is going to happen.
You mentioned timing there. Obviously, temporal dynamics of learning center, that's
right.
About timing. So tell me how timing fits into this whole picture.
Right. So I think I'll just stay with the same example because we already established it. If you take something like the amygdala that's hooked up with all these basic connections so that it can work quite rapidly, it's also possible that things like, say we talk about emotion and social dynamics, these are things that make the amygdala, quote, light up in an fMRI situation, social faces, etc. If you think about it with respect to time rather than content, these are also things that the amygdala must very rapidly apprehend, mm-hmm. right? So if you're slow in a social world, it puts you out of the loop. You just can't be in the synchrony of the crowd, really tossing jokes back and forth, understanding another's intentions rapidly. And so you need some very rapid processing in order to process these things effectively and function well socially. That's adaptive also. And so some of these structures that are able to function on a very rapid time scale are likely involved in these sort of functions. And it turns out that if you look at the amygdala, even though it has a big role in emotion, which I believe it does, you may think that's because there's some sort of content specificity. And it does have its hands, as I say, on all the neuromodulators so that it can actually amp up structures and down. But on the other hand, some of the basic function may just be because it's fast. It's a fast way to make these things happen. And so the time and timing becomes very important with respect to structure and function.
When we were talking earlier, I was talking earlier with Paula Salam and Marnie Stewart Bartlett and a few other people about, at the gross level, the 30,000 foot level of schools, and how to better educate, how to create better learners.
Right.
You can talk about these things like the lessons they're doing, history, geography, science, whatever. You can talk about reading, talk about music. Then you drill down a little bit and you're talking about things like attention and memory, and you drill down a bit further and you're talking about speed of processing at the neuronal level, and you're then talking about cells and so on. So the speed of processing, which was implicit in your example there, these kind of things, and finding out how to possibly even modulate, manipulate and change these things, is that a technique that we're talking about that could possibly end up with information that would help us create better learners?
Oh, I think so. Yes. Yeah, so there are many aspects of it. When you're talking with Paula,
I know that was a big package.
Yeah, when you're talking with Paula Talal, we're talking about the speed of processing in primary cortices, so auditory cortex, rapid auditory processing, perhaps rapid visual processing also. But there's a very close interplay between subcortical structures, those structures beneath the cortex, and their cortical partners, if you will, so that you have this continuous dance that involves the subcortical structures playing their role in also promoting appropriate neuromodulation to cortex at the right time. And that's going to be very important at the basic level for things like spike timing dependent plasticity, other forms of plasticity, et cetera. And often we just think of the sort of decorticate structure, you know, where we look at cortex in isolation of all that regulates its timing. So I think that the subcortical-cortical interactions are going to be key in how exactly it is that these processes are driven. And at the most basic level, you know, we can look at common sense, right? And a lot of data, things that are enjoyed or remembered better, things with any affective content or remembered better. The motivational state of an organism is going to grossly affect how it apprehends information, and you don't want any of this to be impoverished or you get a poor learner.
Could you just do a little gloss for me there, a sort of idiot's guide to what spike dependent timing plasticity is, which the whole notion of plasticity as well, which is crucial to the fact that learning is, education is for life.
Right, so all I'm talking about there is the proximity in time with which one cell fires and another cell fires in terms of their communication. And so that can be altered by a number of things. We've been looking at, within our center and actually within a collaboration with Ken Harris, the state of the brain. Is it awake or is it asleep? That's going to affect how these things proceed. Young Dan and Mooming Poo have been looking at these things quite extensively. They showed that something as simple as a single bursting neuron can change the state of the cortex. Mm-hmm. So this is where, you know, a neuron or two might exhibit a lot of influence on a background state, and then that changes the timing between a couple neurons. And I'm oversimplifying here.
Yeah, well, as long as we get the sort of general picture, I think that's important for people to have some sense of
right. The
sort of gross mechanics of what's going on. So I spoke to Mooming Poo and Yang Dan and Paul as well about this, and they were talking about the notion of, in quotes, addiction, being addicted to
right. Learning.
But I think it's nevertheless a good concept. And I know that this is something you work on as well. Could you tell me about how your rats provide input to this?
Well, we're not sure yet.
Yeah.
So the brain, okay, I'm going to go to a more global concept, and it's going to seem like I'm hopping around, but let me try it, okay? So we have this notion of homeostasis in the brain at the most basic level, that you're always going back to a particular set point so that you can maintain a regulated organism that functions correctly, okay? So that's one view. I'm sure that's true. There are years of data on it. But there's another view too, and that's another level of analysis, and that is that the notion of allostasis. And what that is rather than going back to the same set point, it's the idea of stability through change. Okay? So that means if an organism is in a particular context for long enough, the way to maintain the organism itself is by changing some of these set points. Okay, so an organism that is in a stressful environment for a long period of time is not going to be the same as one who has no biological pressures. So things like heart rate and blood pressure will rise over time. That's actually adaptive to some extent, as is higher arousal levels and stress hormone levels, because you need to be in a different state when you're in a dangerous environment. You need to be in a scanning state, always looking. You don't want to die, right? So you want to be always ready to move. There's a backside to that, though, where it might actually be a bad thing over time because you get less and less healthy, right? So there's also the idea of plasticity in the positive direction. So that idea is that you alter your baseline state towards pure exploration. Say you don't feel the ecological pressures to survive. Say you're in a state where you're free to just explore novelty and to learn. And that is so reinforcing to the organism that what it wants to do is more of that. And that alters your stable state. There are plastic changes in the brain that are likely to go along with that in the same way they are with something negative. So the system can go in both directions. We worry about negative addictions and changing baselines regarding allostasis in the way George Koop talks about it, the dark side of addiction, where the system keeps trying to, is so degraded that it keeps trying to amp up and to the point where taking drugs or something like that is adaptive because you just want to get to a decent state. It isn't even rewarding anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But the absolute opposite of that can occur also, in that the organism can just want more of a good thing because there are no more pressures. They don't need to be in a mode that's cautious. And so in that sense, it could be that learning itself becomes so reinforcing that that's the organism's form of reinforcement, and they become, quote, addicted to learning.
Hmm, interesting. So somebody who's a Marine
right. On
daily duty, in a sense, the good side is that their system has changed to an extent in that it is more overall alert and responsive.
Right.
Downside over time is all that cortisol can't be particularly good for you.
Right, exactly. So you don't want to, too many tours of duty is a bad thing then, right? Because you won't alter your baseline if you keep it up for a little while, but, well, you will a little bit, but it won't be drastic.
So the learning, let's go back to the learning thing again here and bring in another aspect, if you wouldn't mind, which because you were in an unusual situation, actually having been in a class and being a teacher,
right?
Tell me about that.
Well, I started out as a high school math teacher before I went to graduate school, and I taught it. I taught many different classes in math, and it was a very fun time of my life, actually. I was young, the students were young, we learned a lot together, and I just tried to make it as engaging as possible for them. You know, you want the students to be active learners, and you want it to be an experience for them that's active, not a passive experience. You sometimes want to take the lesson in a new direction than planned and go with the interests of the learner so that you can really capture their ability to learn for that day and make sure that you're accurately conveying the information that they're really ready to take in that day. So teaching's a very fluid process, and sometimes it gets diminished to a static process where there's this set curriculum for the day and that's that. And to me, that's a way of perhaps eliminating a disaster in that there's the potential the students wouldn't learn at all, but it's not really a way for promoting the best case scenario.
Yeah, I'm thinking as well about the fact that the meetings we've had recently, that Education Prize Advisory meeting that we had recently, and we produced a number of the most recent press articles, covers of the New York Times Magazine, covers of Newsweek, and so on. And there were stories there, you remember I showed them, which said, how to build a better teacher, fire bad teachers, all this sort of stuff. Now, you know, having been a teacher, this is not as simple as that. And it can't just all be the teacher's problem. It can't all be the state school board officials' problems. It can't all be the... It's a complicated issue. So you're sort of in this territory where you've had a foot in the teaching camp, and you're also at the doing fundamental research, which ought to be able to inform the process of educating and learning.
Right.
So what's that kind of perspective produce in terms of advice from you?
It's not simple advice. Actually, it's a complex process. I think there are a variety of things that science could offer education from the get-go. Some of those are really validation of common sense. And so that's, I think, why science gets a bad name sometimes, because really all you're doing is validating common sense. However, sometimes common sense gets tossed away. You know, I have to say, eliminating PE programs, for example, it seemed to me to be common sense that children should exercise every day. But now, because you have a more fit body, you have more fit vasculature, you have a better brain, the children have reduced their stress levels, everything's better. And exercise relates to the birth of new neurons in the hippocampus also. You know, so you're... From the outset, you have a better organism if you have a fit organism and an exercising organism. Yet PE programs were eliminated in favor of more school time. So, you know, that to me would be common sense. And if science came in and said exercise is good for you, I would imagine the public would be very critical. Like, yeah, no, we know that. Now we need to pay scientists to tell us exercise is good for you, exercise is good for learning. Yet, on the other hand, what's the first cut that gets made in the schools? Daily PE. You know, that's not in many schools anymore.
You could make similar comments about music?
I would make even larger comments about music, actually. Because that goes back to my background in sequence learning. And the music is highly sequential and one of the most rapid, complex sequential processes that the organism can engage in naturally. And it's cross-cultural. And basically, it tunes up both space and time for the brain. And those are very important factors of any type of learning. So, and in addition to things like rapid auditory processing. And so I would say that music should be also one of the building blocks of the schools. And Nina Kraus now has done some really beautiful work that demonstrates the utility of music to the brain and to learning.
At Northwestern.
Yes, and I'm very happy that these studies are being done that really nail down the issues underlying the utility of music.
This is something that fits completely within the ambit of the Temporal Dynamics of Learning
right.
Center as well.
Yes.
So we need to sort of get into the music end of this, I think. Let me ask another, let me just context another area here, which is that the there's a well-known English educational lecturer called Sir Ken Robinson. Ken Robinson. He does this lovely talk, and he tells this story always at the beginning of this talk. And he talks about a classroom of elementary school children, little six-year-olds and so on. And it's a drawing class, right? And there's a little girl there who normally doesn't pay any attention at all, and they've been given a task to draw something. And she's busily going away. She's got her arms curled around, and she's doing this sort of
right.
stuff and so on. And the teacher's a little bit surprised to see what's going on and goes up to her and says, well, what are you doing? And the little girl says, I'm drawing a picture of God. And the teacher looks surprised and says, but nobody knows what God looks like. She says, they will in a minute. Now, the important thing about this, as he tells this wonderful story, is, you know, here's a sort of a little microcosm of the education system, the pluses and minuses. Here's somebody being highly individualistic, just doing their own little thing there. And it reflects back on this notion of the school system as organized by date of manufacture, little batches of things being put out, not much individuality being underscored and supported and so on. So I ask, is there something in what we learn and what the over 100 researchers in the TDLC are working on that will help bring out the individual differences and the individual talents of kids while being applicable to a system? Do you
right.
see the issue?
Yeah, the making things applicable to
Let
the system.
Let her draw a picture of God and at the same
right.
time.
Yeah. Is the most difficult part. The system is, I think, the largest challenge. And so some of the ways in which our centers address this is by basically coming up with individual computer systems that can help an individual child at their own pace with exactly what they need and taking into account the motivational needs and the learning needs of the individual. So that the child for that moment has a place where they're doing exactly what their brain needs maybe some refreshing on at that moment, and they're getting the level of work that they need at that moment. And sometimes in the case of this lab, the machine perception lab, the computer is even recognizing their facial expressions quite fluidly to make sure that they're not too frustrated, to make sure that they're understanding the concepts and slowing down the rate of the presentation according to the viewer's facial expressions, which is pretty sophisticated for a computer. So it's like providing an aid
Teacher's
to the
aid.
Teacher, right. basically.
And eventually, as social robots get better and better,
right.
you'll actually have the...
You can have them as teacher's aids, and it would be economically feasible as well. They may not provide, you know, that sense of warmth that the children desire, but hopefully the teacher will have more time to do that when the students are brought to the level where they can interact with the group and with the teacher.
I think Javier Mavarian was making the point as well that something that is so well calibrated and is focused on a child, i.e. a machine or a computer
right.
program that's working, is sometimes better placed to catch a moment of difficulty than a teacher.
Right.
Whose attention is all over the place to some extent.
Yeah. I mean, we've created a pretty difficult job for our teachers by amping up class sizes. I mean, that's a large attentional load for any human being. And certainly these people are experts and can scan the room and, you know, predict certain things, but it's just too difficult to really always hit the needs of every single student in the class. That's a lot of work.
Yeah. As science director of the TDLC, is it your sense that it's only in being able to have such an interdisciplinary center that these problems can be made really tractable?
Yeah, I think it's an enormous problem. Occasionally, there's a researcher with a laboratory who builds a big enough lab that they can bring in an interdisciplinary group on their own and try to address these problems. That's costly, and it's tough for the one researcher to become sufficiently facile in every area in order to integrate the information. Here we have a team where I can go to, say, Javier, if I read something about information maximization principles that I think should apply to my neurons, and say, okay, well, you know, there are 50,000 web pages on information maximization. There are several books and zillions of papers. Can you teach me something so that I can begin to understand the right place to look? And what would be the most useful reading for me so that I can understand this? And what do you think about this problem? Yeah. So you share the scientific problems in a way that really allows a much keener vision of the problem. So you can work as a team to actually approach it with converging evidence from a bunch of different disciplines, which is important because there are no real answers per se. The other thing that's important is the flip side of that. When you have so many people from different disciplines, you avoid this kind of mutual admiration society where you just embrace the problems in your own field because you can't do anything about them. You know they're there, you know you're making certain assumptions because other people from other fields would say, well, that's ridiculous. You can't make those assumptions. You need to deal with that. And so it really breaks up that feeling of complacency with the particular problems in your field. And I think it's important to have those brought to your awareness frequently, and that's what we do for each other also.
So go back to the beginning of all of this for you. Before they became a school teacher, before all this, scientific parents, a scientific teacher, a book that you read. How did it, what made you go in that direction, science?
I could have done anything, I think. I've always had diverse interests.
Okay.
And was pretty much interested in everything. And I was one of those people that just was, you know, going to get kicked out of college at Berkeley if I didn't declare a major, because I just didn't know which way to specialize. If there had been cognitive science then, that probably would have been a major for me, because I had a combination of lots of science, physiology, and biology, a lot of math, and a lot of psychology.
And well, so, but that was, you weren't doing art, though.
Right. No, I'm a terrible artist, but I was doing music. Yeah, and my mother was a psychometrist and my father was an engineer, so I guess I landed at the interface of that also.
Okay. And so eventually from there, from Berkeley, what happened there? Who were the influences?
From there, actually, it's kind of interesting. I was interested in cognitive psychology, and I worked with a postdoc of Eleanor Roche's extensively on very basic cognitive psychology, semantic memory, categorization.
Eleanor Roche worked on color, didn't she, as well?
Right. Well, she was working on categories then, and cognitive inhibition, and that's right before she sort of switched her interests entirely. And from there, I had a professor approach me because he needed a research assistant on a memory project. And it turned out that he'd gotten a large amount of money from Steve Wozniak. And Steve Wozniak had enrolled in his course under a pseudonym when he'd gone back to get his undergraduate degree. Incidentally, I think it was his dog's name. And he was very engaged in the course. And it turns out he'd gone through, I believe it was a plane crash, and lost his memory and became very interested in memory. And so he donated a large amount of money for something that was called the Wozniak Memory Project. And so I was recruited as a research assistant, and I became totally engaged in that. And then I started testing subjects at the Bay Area Head Injury Recovery Center and really became interested in neuroscience more and started reading a lot. And then I met a woman who had retrograde amnesia as a result of herpes simplex encephalitis. And I began doing a case study on her, and I was fascinated by it. And so I was doing all this while I was teaching math, actually. I was evenings and weekends. And so I decided that I really was going to go back to graduate school and study neuroscience and retrain a bit.
That's interesting. So Wozniak, of course, as I was saying, was one of the, with Steve Jobs, came out with the Mac, right?
Right. We had one of the first Macs.
Right. Bet you did. So, in terms of this center and where you think it can go, and your specific interests, what are the things that are driving you at the moment? What are the next areas that you want to explore in some detail?
Well, I'm interested in, there's a background here that I didn't talk about also, and that's that even though I do rodent work in graduate school, my dissertation was actually on human subjects. So I did both rodent and human work in graduate school. And I think it's an interesting parallel. I like to cross species. I like to try to test out the hypotheses that are gained from the rodent work and see if they still hold remotely for humans. And so often if we study something like learning of neutral items in rodents, we do that in humans as well. So I'll get a graduate student, usually collaborate, and take the question up to human subjects. And in this case of sequential learning and auditory perception, I became very interested in studying music also. And this idea that we're pursuing in the center is not mine. Actually, it was brought to me by a music teacher and an ethnomusicologist. And I embraced it and decided that we should approach music in the same way that we approach other areas of science, and that is, let's let me back up for a second. So there's someone named Alex Khalil in the center who you've met, and
this is the gamelan music,
right? And he teaches children Balinese gamelan. It's interesting because it's obviously musical participation, complex sequence processing, because you have these interleaving rhythms. And interlocking rhythms, rather. But it's also interesting because the children must not only play on their own, they must synchronize to the group. And that group synchronization within this rhythmic structure takes it to the next interesting level of sequence learning and auditory processing. So you have the visual motor and you have the rapid auditory processing. There are huge aspects of attention and sequence learning and memory involved. And presumably, this should drive plasticity in a way that other auditory processing does as well. And so I was very interested in helping him form his work into experiments through many of the center scientists, because as a center, as an individual, I didn't have the proper expertise to deal with his study. But as a center, we do, actually. So I worked a little bit as a scientific broker for him, lining up the right team. And I think we have an exquisitely designed study. And then one of my graduate students who worked on neural recording and auditory processing in rodents is going to take all the techniques that he learned computationally and apply that to the music in children. So that's the sort of thing we can approach as a center. And then the question is, you know, does this help tune up auditory processing in children? Can it be remedial for children who have problems with attention and with group synchrony? And is this an interesting way that educators should go about teaching the ability to rapidly auditorily process and have group synchrony? And then, do you need Balinese gamelan, or are there other ways? What are the fundamental pieces that are important here?
Yeah, you say children, of course, that one of the things that came up in conversations recently, because we're also doing a lot of work, conversations with researchers in the whole field of aging, is that education is, as I said, education is for life. It's a lifelong process. The brain's plasticity continues. So some of these fundamental explorations into speed of processing, into attention, into memory, synchrony, I assume that the same story could be applied to aging boomer populations.
Right, so development is a lifespan process. Yeah. And on the flip side, certainly this applies to aging. I mean, I would have a personal example by going back and taking a dance class with my daughter when I hadn't danced for 25 years. And I could not believe how difficult it was for me to remember sequences. I was pathetic. Right. And so it was an indicator, and I knew what I was like when I was young. I was not so pathetic. And so it was an indicator that certainly I should, you know, be doing many sequencing activities in my life to maintain this level of plasticity.
Oh, but you're able to figure out what that should be, right? You could design this for yourself.
Yes, yes.
And often what I found is that you have neuroscientists who've got kids and know all this wonderful stuff, and I say to them, well, are you right. implementing that with your children? Well, not exactly. I mean, it's almost like there should be a sort of a neuroscience school for...
Yeah, that would be wonderful. I mean, you have to go with the interests of the kids, too, so you sort of want a menu approach.
Yeah.
In my opinion. You know, these dance, tap dancing, group music, all of these things train, you know, rhythmic processing, yeah. rapid auditory processing and synchronization, you know, and then there may be other forms of art that are very important, and it could be drawing, it could be photography, you know, tune other aspects of the system. So you could have an ongoing sort of menu in a way, and you want the child to choose what they want to do because there's the affective content. It needs to be rewarding to the individual. And I'm not for making uniform little individuals.
Right.
We don't want to wipe out the diversity.
Thinking back over your career and so on, a student of yours just did a thesis defense.
Right.
Yeah, young scientist in the making. There was a book by Sir Peter Medawar called Advice to a Young Scientist.
Right.
What's your advice to a young scientist?
don't
say read Medawar's book. What's your personal sense?
Well, I probably give bad advice.
That's not what I heard.
No, I think you should go with your passion, actually, because I think that the scientific setting can be very exhausting and difficult and sometimes a little bruising, and you need to be resilient. And for me, the best form of resilience is making sure that the work I'm doing is something that I really want to be doing. So sometimes there's money out there for certain types of translation to medicine that are very lucrative, and those may be a really good thing to do, but if it's not my primary interest, it's not going to keep me going through the downs. And so for me, you know, aligning your interests to useful things is really important. So I say go with your passion.
Yeah. You have, I think we've talked about this before, you have a non-trivial interest in politics as well, in the science and society issues. There is obviously a way, and we talk in the center about in-reach and outreach, in other words, not just scientists from on high condescendingly preaching to this ill-educated general public out there. That's not the attitude we have. We like to do the in-reach, outreach thing. The place of science in society then, this is the 350th anniversary year of the foundation of the Royal Society, so it's a nice milestone. And I'm thinking and asking people about the president's undertaking in his inaugural address to restore science to its rightful place. So what do you think the rightful place of science is?
I think science should be central to society, and it shouldn't be something that few of us do or know about. I think part of it is there's this veil as though it's very difficult, and that's been perpetuated by scientists to some extent. You know, people would like acknowledgement for what they do. Sometimes science isn't the most high-paying job in the world, and so then you want to feel like you have some intellectual presence in the world. And the truth is that anything done very systematically in life is not all that difficult. So if you give children a really good scientific education from day one, it'll bring the population up to snuff on scientific issues. It's moving so quickly that you can't possibly understand everything, but if there's lots of information available, people should be at a point at least where they can apprehend information that's interesting to them or worth something to them, so that more people can be involved in science also.
I mean, the stuff that is done in here, right. in the TDLC. I mean, is so. I mean, that's such interesting stuff that I would have thought the general audiences would just eat it up.
I would think so, but science is often taken out of context, right? So you, if you read the title, any title of one of our papers, not any title, but most, it'll sound so esoteric that people will wonder why the taxpayers are wasting their money on this or that problem, because it's completely out of context. And so it's providing a rich context so that people understand why these things are interesting to them.
Here's my little question that I always ask people. I give you a token for time travel. You can have to a dinner party and ask questions of and have a conversation with anybody you like. Some scientists, if you like, other people. Who would you dearly love to sit down and talk to?
I don't know. There are probably too many people. You know, I'd probably choose Cannonball Adderley first. So, and I'm probably the only one that would say that.
So, in fact, if you hadn't been a scientist, do you think you'd have been a musician?
Is that? I probably wasn't good enough. So I may have been a local musician, but not a renowned musician. But who knows? Maybe if I'd thrown myself into it, yes. But yeah, I think I would probably invite Cannonball Adderley. He was a teacher, incidentally, also.
Really?
Yeah. And his music always interested.
Do you think he would have a good conversation with Donald Hebb?
Probably so. Or at least Miles Davis would have, because he said a lot with science, and Hebb's notion is to say a lot with silence. I mean, not science, with silence. Yeah. And Hebb says that the brain said a fair amount with silence also, so there may be more overlap there.
Let me get your thoughts on one other thing here about getting the message out. This is a book by Cornelia Dean, who used to edit the Science Times page, New York Times. Book's called Am I Making Myself Clear? A Scientist's Guide to Talking to the Public, and she cites in here a study from Nancy Barron up at in Santa Barbara, who runs the Communication Partnership for Science. And when she asks scientists what irks them about the news media, the same responses come over and over again. Journalists oversell their stories. News reports don't offer information in enough detail to help readers or viewers form opinions. Journalists don't see where the important point is, emphasize side issues. They don't understand and therefore cannot explain nonlinear probabilistic aspects of research. They confuse science issues with values issues. They approach their stories with erroneous underlying assumptions. They look for controversy, seek erroneous balance. So the end result is that researchers view journalists as insufficiently concerned with accuracy, superficial sensationalists, focused on controversy and intention, right. Ignorant, unethical, willing to do anything to get the story, and the journalists think that researchers are boring, hair-splitting, caveating things to death, overly interested in process, unable to articulate a bottom line, and users of an unintelligible jargon. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, sure.
How do we go about fixing some of that sort of stuff?
We probably need a middle layer. So the Science Network serves that. Right. So people that are actually scientists who decide that they're going to take a more journalistic aspect to the science so that they can communicate the science in a way that's as close as possible to the science, because we all generalize when we're trying to make a point. And remain true to the science and also true to the public. Yeah. So I think it's sort of a layering process that needs to happen.
Yeah. The one of the problems seems to be that there's a disconnect, though, between the organism walking around, sitting down, having its tea, going to the ball game and doing all this other stuff, and the fact that it's neurons that are doing it. You know, if I pick up a paper like oxytocin receptor genetic variation relates to empathy and stress reactivity in humans, that's really important stuff, actually. You're talking about neurochemistry going on, underlying biochemistry and so on. Oxytocin implied in some deficits like autism and so on. Obviously, you know, these juices and neurons and so on are what makes us us. But there's a disconnect between that at the bench work and you know, real life. I just don't know how we get into that.
Well, there are a lot of assumptions that people make in many directions. So I guess it would be the willingness to make assumptions that that's sufficient for the human condition, actually. And then from there, we really don't have the techniques yet in neuroscience to look at really what makes us us. The genetic techniques are coming along nicely, mm-hmm. but what we can't do is measure neurochemical proportionalities at any high temporal resolution. So if you could go in and look at the proportion of different neurochemicals being released to a particular area at a particular time, under a particular situation, it would be very revealing, I'm sure. And, Terry has a book on that in some respects.
Do you think that these investigative techniques, which are coming together, you know, fMRI mm-hmm. and so on, all the other techniques, might eventually, however, lead to more of a science of individuality?
I would think so, yes. Yeah. You need to be able to get... So right now we're sort of relegated to looking at parts in many instances. You know, where do we have our wires in the brain so that we can look at specific populations of neurons? We try to look at the ensemble. A lot of the information about the whole system is through reconstruction, through mathematical models. That's a very important issue so that we can make predictions about what we should find, because it's very difficult to reconstruct. With respect to neuroscience. But as techniques get better, I would think that we would get a more whole brain view, a view inside of the brain.
Yeah. So what are you optimistic about at this point?
I'm optimistic that we'll move further with neurochemistry. So I happen to think that neuromodulation is an enormous issue with respect to individual differences, with respect to timing in the brain and the function of the brain. And we're good at looking at proteins in the form of receptors, but we're not good at looking at the whole profile of neurochemistry at one time. And it's got to be a proportional issue, I think, with respect to individual differences. So I'm optimistic that someone will come along and innovate that. There are a few things creeping out now. Some view them as leading edge, others view them as rudimentary. Probably both are correct, but I think we'll get further with respect to the neurochemistry. I think there's an opening in neuroscience for really good electrochemists also. So the physicists have become interested in neuroscience, and that's really helped us from a computational perspective, and I would hope that electrochemists might get interested in neuroscience also.
So again, more of these silos being destroyed, more walls going down.
Right, right. Yeah, we need more expertise. I mean, the brain is too complex.
Yeah. Well, I know you've got, in just over a week, a National Science Foundation site visit for renewal of the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center, and I think you therefore probably have quite a bit on your plate, so thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
We'll catch up next time.
Thanks, Roger.
Okay.